for the months and years to come.
Beatriz Ochoa, we want to thank you for being with us. Norwegian Refugee Council's Latin America Head of Advocacy, joining us from Caracas, Venezuela. Again, it's believed over 100 Venezuelans deported to Venezuela just hours before the earthquakes have perished. That does it for our show. We'll post a Spanish interview with Beatriz at democracynow.org. Also, we're hiring an education program manager and fundraising and outreach interns. Find out more at democracynow.org/jobs. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Online and archived at KFAI.org, the community's true voice.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. Today is the end of the month, June 30th, 2026. What a month it's been, what a summer it's been so far, and what a season we're into. I'm thinking about politics 2026, what's on the table, what the stakes are for moving our communities forward. I'm thinking that major challenges and major opportunities ahead. But I also think that we are equal to the task. We know it has to be done. Basically, we got to get out. Everybody's got to get out. And so make sure that you and everybody in your household, your neighborhood, your friends, your network shows up and votes. And I don't care how you vote, though I really do. The most important thing is that you vote. We've got to express our position, our priorities, our interest, and we have to have a change. And the change we need affects all the elements of our life, from economic development, wealth building, home ownership, health, civic engagement, identity, the sense of decency and of being a human being. All of this is on the table right now. I will. So we'll talk about these things and more over the course of the next hour. Again, thank you for being here. Shout out to all of our KFAI audience and those who are joining us on any of the social media networks. We're streaming live to Facebook and to LinkedIn, as well as YouTube for the Insight News channel, the Black Press America channel, Black Press USA. Let's start by bringing a couple of guests in who are involved in the housing issue. I've been an advocate and a friend of Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity forever. And right now I have the fortune of introducing and interviewing the staff of the organization and their program officer. Catherine Penkirk is chief of staff of Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. Catherine, welcome to the program. And she's also joined by her colleague and my friend, Charisse Turner, a person that everybody knows community for her good work and her great voice, great vision. Guys, welcome to the conversation. And Charisse, unmute you. There you go.
Thank you so much, Mr.
Let's set the stage. Sure. Catherine, let me start with you. The stage by giving us Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity 101. What is the organization? What's the mission, the vision, and what are the challenges and opportunities ahead?
Ooh, big question. I'll start and Charisse, you chime in. I think big picture, we want it to be possible for everyone who wants to own their own home to do so. And we believe that that is possible. And I think what's really unique about the Habitat model is that we also, you mentioned civic engagement in your opening. We invite everyone in community together to help make that possible. So through whether it's volunteering, whether it's donating money, whether it's being an advocate at the Capitol, there are so many ways that our whole community can come together and help work with folks who want to buy a home to achieve that dream. And then Charisse can speak. I don't want you speak, Charisse, to how we work with the homeowners and what's so special about that side.
Yeah, thank you. We start in community by showing up in, communities that we're developing in, but also just communities that are surrounding the 7-county metro. And this is something new for us. You know, in the past, we didn't have an outreach team, but now we do. We got that team that goes out there and they spread the word about the importance of stabilization, but also home ownership and how we make it affordable. And most people don't really see themselves partnering with Habitat in that way because they think it's for someone else. And I'm here to say that in order for us to sustain our affiliate, we also have to attract those who didn't see themselves partnering with us. So we're looking for homeowners who's making between $60,000 and $131,000. Their mortgage payment would never be more than 30% of their income. And that's the game changer, where you're getting into home ownership with an affordable mortgage to really focus on stabilization and build generational wealth for your family. So that is where, our donors and volunteers help us offset that cost so we can keep it affordable to our home buyers. You know, Mr. McFarland, I wanted to also just mention that this feels like a full circle.
Sure.
As we started with, a few years back, having this conversation with you about our Advancing Black Home Ownership program. And here we are almost 4 years in, mm-hmm. and we're seeing some major improvements as it relates to foundational Black home buyers accessing home ownership. So I just want to mention that because we actually started with your show to just launch the Advanced Black Home Ownership Program.
That's awesome. Let me tell people more about both of you. Catherine Penkirk, Chief of Staff, leads the organization's strategic alignment and executive operations. She oversees their government affairs and advocacy, marketing, communications work, and she works in partnership with the diversity, equity, and inclusion teams. She's got over 15 years of cross-sector experience, including leadership roles at Greater MSP and at the City of St. Paul. She has master's degrees in public policy and social work. She's committed to equity and innovation and community impact. She lives in St. Paul with her family, her husband, and children. And Charisse, who serves Chief Program Officer at Habitat for Humanity, leads the Program and Services Division, including home ownership development, community engagement and outreach, foreclosure prevention, and post-purchase services. She's also leading the organization's strategic partnerships, and she leads the work to advance Black homeownership through cross-sector collaboration focused on transforming program delivery and strengthening access to down payment resources. So I started off saying that we're in a difficult situation, difficult time here in Minnesota. Here's the conundrum as I see it. Number one, the ownership gap maybe shrinking now. Charisse, you can talk about that in a couple of seconds. And if it's not shrinking substantially right now, it's on track because of the work that you are doing. And there are other organizations like Build Wealth Minnesota and a variety that are all focused on this. And we've all been doing this work together for years. So we've been looking at the problem, but not just admiring it, trying to do the work to figure out how to deliver opportunity for wealth creation through home ownership. We'll talk about that. Let's start with that. Jump in, Charisse.
Yeah, I just want to first thank you for allowing us to come in and talk a little bit more about the Advancing Black Homeownership Initiative. Well, it's not an initiative anymore because it's an actual program. And, you know, it started with, I joined Twin Cities Habitat in 2018, and I just remember bringing some of those voices with me, and they were curious, just habitat work in our community. And I wasn't sure that we did, so we did a deep dive to understand who were we serving and who we had left behind. And it was very clear that in our program, this affiliate, we had left our foundational Black community on the sidelines. And at the time, they were our second largest applicant who had the least success. And I was curious about why that was. So we started an engagement project with Dr. Brittany Lewis in late 2020 to do an engagement process with us, just to understand the challenges and the, you know, distinct barriers that they were having in our program. And it was very clear that, you know, this program that we had was a one shoe fit all. And it was very, also very clear that that wasn't working for this demographic. So we paused and we listened and we got recommendations, and then we applied those recommendations to our program, which is now our Advancing Black Homeownership Program that started here at our affiliate. But then we also knew that we didn't want to keep it here at this affiliate. We needed to, if we're going to really start to close that wealth gap, then we need to partner differently. And we did. So we built a group of other housing organizations that had a focus on home ownership. And now we've morphed this program that was once at our affiliate is now a community fund. And we are seeing some really major strides here with trying to close the gap. We got a long way to go, but I definitely think we've put a dent in there, and we're not done. So it is our hope that at some point we can celebrate and say that we are really closing the gap in our region. And there is still some opportunities for us to take it to the next level. And now we're rethinking even what the post-purchase support looks like. We're reimagining mm-hmm. the post-purchase support now by taking that experience, and homeowners are helping us build this other program. So, you know, Habitat is just leaning in, you know, and doing things differently and not just relying on word of mouth. It's like we have to be really intentional about getting the word out in our community for us to really see some changes. So I'm pretty excited about this work and working in collaboration with other programs like Build Wealth and PRG and PPL is really making some major contributions to closing this homeownership gap for sure.
So I was thinking that I'm concerned about the political environment, the White House and the MAGA right really rolling on progressive and I think decent communities, ordinary Americans, and certainly people of color, Black people. Catherine, how do you navigate in this environment? Because the impact of that pressure from Washington has caused a collapse and a paralysis in the nonprofit and in the government sector in Minnesota. So lots of organizations that depend on the pipeline for funding now find themselves in a place of uncertainty because funds are being withheld, funds are being threatened, their organizations are being threatened. There have been some problems that have been used to paint with a broad stroke anything and everything that was intended to resolve the ongoing crises. Catherine, what do you think? And as you explained that, I'm going to bring in a couple other guests who are both relatives of mine, but also eminently qualified to join this conversation. Go ahead, Catherine.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, saying it's a difficult time is like the understatement of the century. It certainly is. I think we definitely feel that here. We see it here. It shows up in impacts to our community members we're working with, our staff, you know, everyone, the whole community. I think our approach has really been, we are not changing who we are. We're not changing our values. And it's our job. One of our values is inspired by hope. And so we want to continue to practice hope And the idea that, you know, hope is a practice, it's a choice, it's a discipline. And how can we be a place of hope, a beacon of hope through an incredibly turbulent time when we don't know what tomorrow brings? And so, you know, what does it look like for us to stay really rooted and committed to our mission, to be really clear-eyed about who we're working with and why and what we're doing, and to also be adaptive and recognize things have changed. The environment has changed. There are different pressures, you know, and so how do we not get paralyzed, but really think about, okay, so what do we do tomorrow? And it might look a little bit different. Our why hasn't changed, mm-hmm. but the how and the what of how we get there, you know, might need to look a little bit different. I think I'm immensely proud to be part of this team and very grateful to show up to work here every day, because I think something, you know, a lot of folks are struggling with right now is just feelings of despair and like, you know, what is there a path out of this? You know, how, what are we doing? What's going on here? Right. And I think when you walk through the door with Habitat, and whether it's the physical door at our office or the metaphorical door, you step onto a build site and you help build a house with us, you show up at a community engagement event, you know, wherever that is, I think people reconnect with that sense of meaning because they remember, oh yeah, we're in it together. Our whole community, we're in it together. And as long as we keep showing up for each other, we're going to be okay. And I think we really want to stay focused on being a place and being an organization that helps people have those experiences, because that's going to give us the fuel to keep going.
Stephen Sykes is a broadcaster, podcaster, organizer out in the Richmond, Virginia area. Stephen, welcome to the program. His business name is Mr. LP, and also joining us is another person that's a relative of mine who lives here in St. Paul, who I've known for years till we found out we were related, and that's Jesse Overton. And as I mentioned, these are two gentlemen who have two brothers who've got experience in building community, in wealth building, and we're kind of meeting in this place for the first time together. And but all of us want to sit with you, Catherine and Charisse, talking about both the opportunity, the reasons for the problems, but also the hope, as you mentioned, Catherine, that solutions are at hand. That in fact, we're going to win, and we're going to survive, and we're going to thrive, because we have that intention, we have that mission, we've got a history of winning. Jesse, Stephen, brothers, how y'all doing? Good to see you. Welcome to the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be amongst intelligent people.
I concur.
Well, Stephen, start.
Be on your program, and I want to thank you for the gift of history, of the stories that show us where we came from, and the people whose lives shaped the communities we cherish today. I can't help but say several comments here. In the 50s, Gandhi, nonviolence. 60s, Martin Luther King, nonviolence, civil rights movement in America. Nelson Mandela, 27 years imprisonment, had to figure out what the next step is. And I think we're right where Nelson was. What is our next step to make sure that we can take this uncertainty away and move forward?
Brother, Mr. LP, jump in. What are your thoughts? What are your impressions?
My impression, first of all, thank you, ladies, for the good work that you do in the communities. It is very much needed. The thing about it, I would say with intention, is that the work is already there. The layout is there. People have to also learn to run the race that they're in, because everybody, there are those who are so energetic and get involved, but we tend to be all over the place. One of the things that I caution our communities, regardless of housing in so many different areas, is stay in the lane that we're in. And granted, we may have skills and be able to do multiple things, but we need to work together as a team with sound mind, one movement, one goal. And when people jump into so many different lanes, we tend to get lost in things and not worry about the credit or the money and all these other things, because all those things would eventually would take care of itself. The main thing is just getting us housed, getting our communities to grow and stay in line and informed, and focus on not being the gatekeeper, playing gatekeeper towards elevation that we have within ourselves.
Catherine, Charisse, jump in.
Yeah. You know, Mr. LP, you bring up a really good point, you know, about the lane that we're in. And then I think this is why it's so important that we approach this work as a collective, working in community with other housing organizations that had a focus on closing the home ownership gap, you know, because now you're working with like-minded organizations and individuals, right? And I just want to make one point that Habitat, you know, historically have always served home buyers and homeowners in our communities of color. But it was really important for us to understand who we had left behind, you know. So leaning into our data was really critical, especially as I was just getting started here at Habitat. And I didn't really know Habitat very well. I know it's a international brand, but I really didn't know them. I didn't quite understand how they worked, you know, who was even working here, who did they serve. It was very important for me to understand, like, who did we not serve very well, because that's the opportunity, right? And that work really led us to work in collaboration with other organizations who were already doing this work. Habitat was pretty much late to the party as it relates to understanding who we had missed. And that was a game changer for us, because we didn't understand that we had left our Black community on the sidelines. You know, we followed immigration trends, you know, and we paused. And it was important for us to pause and listen. And when we talk about collaborating with our community, we took that to heart, because we can't take credit for creating the ABH program, the Advancing Black Home Ownership Program. Our community helped us shape that work. We just took their recommendations and implemented it into our program. So I understand the totality of what it means to work in community, but also to listen, you know, and that is something that we're doing now. We have to listen. We have to get that qualitative feedback, because that is where you start to shape and change things to those that you're serving. Yeah.
One of the things I want to add into that is, and you bring up a very excellent point in terms of listening, but also I need to add in comprehension. Yes. Because that's a big part of this.
Absolutely.
And people need to take the time out. If you don't know, ask questions. And this is not something for those people in the Black mm-hmm. community or those people within our Asian community. It's for everybody.
Absolutely.
And learn to apply what's needed, because all things does not work in all communities. We would love to sit there and have a plan that works for everybody, but it doesn't work that way. Life does not afford itself that way. So what happens in Minnesota may need to be, the plan and structure is in place, but it has to be in its right form, say Arizona or Montana or Texas, wherever it may mm-hmm. be. So we need to make sure that we have a comprehension, because now we're start operating without a license and intelligently mm-hmm. in terms of our language and how we move. And then with that information, then now we can go to our local businesses. And now, like you said, you have this data, you have this information, and now they could say, point to, hey, if you do this, this will happen in our community. These can grow. We already know the information for a number of years about what happens when you have more homeowners in our communities. And mm-hmm. we do understand that not everybody is meant to be a homeowner. Not everybody should be a homeowner. But when you have the majority are homeowners in the community, that's provided a level of stabilization and people work within our communities, it works. That's why you see the growth of these city centers in various areas, especially in the East and West Coast. That is important.
Yes, thank you. That's a great point. You know, and I wanted to also just mention that it was important for us to also attract staff with lived experiences. You know, you can't be what you don't see, you know. So to have a staff with the story that they can tell to those that we're serving is a little bit of motivation, you know. And I thought that was really important. You know, is that we have our staff that also reflect those of the communities that we're serving too. So that lived experience is something that we don't take for granted, but we also understand that it's necessary. You know, when you have when you have staff that understands, you know, what it took for them to access home ownership, we're able to share and motivate others. And there is no, you know, one program don't fit everybody, and that's what we understood. And we're taking more of that person-centered approach in, you know, how we're supporting home buyers that trust us to provide them some supportive resources to, you know, access home ownership for sure. But thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
What would you say we could do from a macro standpoint?
Yeah, go ahead.
From a macro standpoint, to leverage the equity that we have as a community to free up additional capital that's necessary. I don't think we've harnessed the leverage that we could do collectively. And yet I agree with all the comments made about the micromanagement, not everybody, but it really comes down to we've been denied in this country equity intentionally. And we have a lot of people that are afraid to talk about it because they want to take a different approach. But at the end of the day, this is an economic sustainability issue for the long term. Across this country, African Americans have been herded like cattle. In Nashville, Tennessee, where the encampments were, they were meant to go to the slaves. Today, the most valuable property in Nashville is a piece of land around the state capitol and Fisk University. But the economic inclusion is the exclusionary policies. So while you have this great program, what can we do to leverage our economic power that puts more force behind your program?
Yeah. I can jump in, Catherine, if you don't mind. Think it's important, one, that, you know, we need everybody to talk about the importance of home ownership, right?
Right.
You know, as you're talking, you know, advocating, you know, there's some policy changes, reform, you know, but what we don't talk a lot about is how do we preserve that? Because we do contribute a lot to folks accessing home ownership, but we're also thinking about how you're going to be successful in it, right? You know, so that preservation and stabilization is equally important, especially for me, understanding even what my family went through with not able to retain their 17 acres in White Cloud, Michigan, because families were fighting about, you know, do we sell it or do we maintain it, you know? And I wish I knew what I knew today then, you know, because I could have easily stepped in when my mom and her siblings were feuding, you know, like the value of land, because if it was not important, they wouldn't try so hard to keep us out of it, you know? So it's just, for me, it's a lived experience. I know the importance of this. I know when I was stable and had home for my children, they were able to, you know, flourish at school, and they were able to be their individual selves and go out here and do amazing things. And I can look back and say that home provided them that, you know. Now they're homeowners and shaping their children's lives. I'm a grandmother now, right? You know, I just think about all of the things that was so valuable then when I didn't really see that. I'm leaning into it right now, which is why I want to get out there and make sure people understand the importance of it, but it just doesn't end at the closing table. The work is just beginning at the closing table, because I want you to be successful in home ownership, not only getting to it, but through it.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, ma'am. Sorry.
Well, I was going to build a little on what Therese is saying and say the policy environment is really important to creating possibility to unlock capital. Like you said, how do we help shift the market? And I think that's something that people maybe don't know about Habitat. They know our direct service work with individuals and families well, but we also are really involved in advocacy and systems change. And I think it's important in the spirit of like, where are the bright spots, that housing really is a bipartisan issue in this country right now. It's not great news that everyone everywhere is struggling with it. However, that means there is some level of unanimity or agreement that we need to do some different things and bigger things, because the housing market is really not working for anyone in America. And so there was you may have saw the headlines last week, a really big bill passed in Washington, the Road to Housing Act. Now the president has not yet signed it. There are still paths to get that done. If you talk to folks who've worked in housing for their whole career, they will say The fact that housing is a major top line issue in DC, at the state level, at the local level, it hasn't always been that way. That this is very positive right now, that elected leaders really understand this is a core fundamental human issue. And so I think, Mr. McFarland, you opened talking about voting and elections. I think folks really understanding at every level of government this fall, you have the chance to vote on housing policies and you have the chance to vote on affordability. And there are really real and meaningful ideas on the ballot. And so that is a way to, I think, influence what's possible.
I wanted to give Mr.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. And listening to a great conversation about home ownership and housing being presented by Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. You guys are going to leave with a couple of seconds. You're welcome to stay. I'm going to continue the conversation with Jesse Overton and Stephen Sykes, Mr. LP. But thank you, Twin Cities Habitat, Sharice Turner, Catherine Benker, for your leadership, your service. How can people get in touch with you? Somebody wants to buy a house today and you want to help them. How do they connect?
They can jump, go right to our website, www.tchabitat.org. And there's a landing page all about home ownership. And for those that already, who are already homeowners, we have some resources that are available too. If you're looking, you know, perhaps you want to need to repair, we have a repair program. We think about not only the full person, but the house too. So, you know, it's not about just helping folks get into home ownership. We also want to help them get through it, you know, and preserving these homes is equally important as creating those opportunities. So they can always check out our website, lots of information there. And they can also come into one of our information sessions that we have on, as a matter of fact, the next one is going to be, I believe, July 17th. That's going to be virtual, but that all of that's on the website.
Super.
And if I can put in a little plug for a campaign we're launching soon called Pope Leo Village. And this is really a project that's about how do we put faith into action and how do we touch into mm-hmm. that sense that we're part of something bigger than ourselves, right? So we are the 20th Habitat affiliate across the country to launch Pope Leo Village. And Pope Leo Village is just a way to recognize the idea that we all have a responsibility to care for each other, that serving in community is how we make meaning of our lives. And moral courage, you know, what can we learn from the example of Pope Leo right now? And so we are putting kind of a special call out. Anyone who is a person of faith or feels motivated or called right now, how do I show up in my community? How do I help build with my neighbors? We want you to come in and build with Habitat. And so if you click around on that website, you can find information on the Pope Leo Village. And if you or your faith community or your school community, if anyone wants to get involved, we'd love to have you.
Catherine Benker, Sharice Turner, thank you both so very much. Again, hang out as long as you can. I know you got other things to do. I want to focus now, shift to my cousin, Jesse Overton. Jesse just came back from a major event in Tennessee that I'm excited about, and I want him to tell the story. And Jared, can you pull up the slide? There's a cover of the Tennessean newspaper, and Jesse is on the cover of the publication celebrating the powerful example and legacy of his forebears. Jesse, tell that story, and thank you again so much for sharing it with me. And before we went on today, you were talking about, you know, how we have to move the generations now and forward back to an awareness of how much we have done as a people, how phenomenal we have shown up despite every odd being against us and despite all the hostility, all the violence, all the policy, the legal entanglement, slavery as the policy of the state. And despite that, we've come through and we continue to rise. But Jesse, tell us about your family, the Overtons, and particularly the ones that you celebrated last month in Tennessee.
Well, thank you, Al, for the opportunity to share the story. I could share it, and it would take about 10 hours. I'll try to do a condensed version. I received a call from a young lady by the name of Aisha Samuels, and she is the CEO of the Ben Franklin Institute in Boston. And she said, "Mr. Overton, I don't want to call you Mr., but I think we're related." And I said, "How so?" And she said, "Hiram and Evelyn Overton." I said, "Now we're talking, because that's my great-grandparents, not my great-great, but my great-grandparents." Hiram was born in 1835. My father's father was born in 1887. And my dad was born in 1902, and I'm born in 1950. So when my dad married my mother, he was 44. The first child was a daughter, and I was the second when he was 48. What's interesting is that Hiram emancipated himself. Mm-hmm. He left his wife and went with the Pennsylvania Cavalry to share the horses and take care of the wagons. After the war was over, he went to the 60th Congress to get remuneration, along with a neighbor he rented from sometime. And he was really insulted in many ways about, was he there just to cover for his white master? Who owned him? That sort of thing. Why was he there? And he said, "Well, you know, birds are free. Basically, why wouldn't I want to be free?" And he gave all the correct answers, but he died before he could be reenumerated. Hiram's idea was that he worked hard, gave the money to his wife, and they reinvested in livestock and land. Well, he wasn't just buying it and making the money to make it. He wanted to create generational wealth. And so he passed the homes to his sons and his daughters so that they didn't have to start all over again. And like you mentioned earlier, Cherise, sometimes you have family squabbles, and there were some. What was interesting about Hiram, according to the state, was that he accumulated in his lifetime about 800 acres. He was not frivolous with money, but probably the most important thing he did was he opened a school at Otter Creek Road, Grand and White Pike, for African Americans, and put his own kids in the school. This was documented by Reverend Daniel Burke, who went around the country and did the progression of the African-American in Canada in the U.S. Now, I don't take any claim for this. You don't get to pick your parents or great-grandparents, but I can see what he did, how it affected our family. He made my grandfather promise to him, who had a sixth grade education, Hiram had no education, that he would give his son a better education than he got. And W.E. Du Bois and the Great Compromise discussion both thought they would make points with Hiram. And they asked him, "What are you going to do for your kids?" And he said, "First, they're going to have a skill. And second, I'm going to send them to the best university in Nashville, which is Fisk University. I'm not sure that that's going to benefit them as much as I would like for it to. It's yet to be determined." Well, my dad went to Fisk, then Meharry, became a dentist. And all of his children were well-educated. And today, the prodigy is doing fairly well. I wouldn't say we're doing as great as we would like to be. What's interesting about the state, they studied Hiram for about 8 years before they agreed that what they were hearing was correct, because there were many stories that were never recorded. But as I mentioned to my cousin Al here, they kept such good records about African Americans that it's really beneficial for everyone to go back and look at the census and see who their relatives were and get a real handle for the progress that they were making that's never really talked about. So our story is one that's replicated with many African Americans across this country, and the progression was substantial enough that if you go back and look at all of the obstacles or hurdles that were put in front of our people in Nashville, they were the same in all places we migrated to in the United States. Equity we don't have today. If we want to talk about transparency, we have to look at what are the key elements we have to have an effect on immediately. And one of them is, how do we create generational wealth? So after this was over, we went to the Travelers Rest plantation, and the state gave a complete accounting of all the property that he owned. I found it very fascinating that every African American, they have cataloged, and they know what land they lived on and where they moved from and what their accomplishments were. So long before we had integration, we had people graduating from fine institutions in this country. Du Bois was the first, one of the first to go to Harvard. There's been a somewhat of an inclusion in diversity, but equity, no. And it's been deliberate. And so our families today are under attack, and we're kidding ourselves if we think they're getting literacy and numeracy. About 3% of us are doing okay. The rest are being denied a decent education. So knowing all of that, and now the last 50 years, I think we have to look at what is the next step. One thing I can share is that Hiram didn't leave anything uncovered with, so there would be a fight immediately in the family. Each one got a place to live. They had a skill. And then as they died, it then was wheeled back to members of the family. But then you got someone doesn't like someone you get into, and they sell off a valuable piece of property for $6,000. And in the next 15 years, it's worth over $1.5 million. And this is pretty prevalent. The good news is that Nashville is beginning to experience a different type of engagement with the African-American community. And that engagement is, you want to develop and be a tier one city, then you need to leave all of those other people in other parts of Williamson County and the rest of Tennessee in their place. Because if they come into Nashville like they're trying to do in Memphis and jerry-rig the election, you're not going to be a place where people want to come. A lot of my colleagues are saying, we really have to send a message to the banking system. And the way to do it is through our checking and savings accounts and our investments. And what piece of equity do you really have an opportunity to that? And that is with your mortgage. And so there's a lot of discussion about private banking among our family members. Some believe it's not a good way to go. We need to leverage our collective family investments. And so I'm very proud to share that with you, because on the street I grew up on were the McKissicks, and they became one of the premier architectural firms in the United States. And Nashville's kind of like Tuskegee. It was within a bubble, but it was a nice bubble where people came, and if they didn't stop in Nashville, they went to Detroit or other parts of the United States. So my son is the third, Jesse the third, and my first grandson is the fourth. And so the whole conversation after that was, there's too many Jessies in the family. So I wish I could give you more detail about the state and what they're doing in Tennessee. Don't be misled that Davidson County is like Williamson County and Chattanooga and Knoxville. We have a family there that grew up in White Bear by the name of the Ingram. And Martha Ingram, when was watching the Black Lives Matter movement here, when they went on the freeway and discovered that people from another country came over and were part of the conflict on the freeway. When that movement went to Nashville, she met with the police chief and she said, you're going to take off your guns, you're going to make all your captains come down and bang all the coffee and tea, and you're going to tell those marchers that you're there to make sure they're protected. You're going to put troops on Charlotte Avenue and on DeMurman, which run parallel, and any rednecks and any weird people that want to cause violence, you're going to take care of them, and we're going to make sure that we don't have a bad situation. Well, they already know in Nashville, if you have that, nobody wants to come to your city. So how do they get their new Super Bowl? They don't have a stadium, right? They built a new stadium. They said, well, it's safer. You can walk from any restaurant in Nashville to the new stadium, and you're safe. You can't do that in Minneapolis. You know, so there's a lot.
Let me shout out one of my colleagues who recently transitioned to becoming an ancestor in Nashville, and that's Rosetta Perry. I don't know if you knew her at all or not.
I know.
She was the Rosetta Perry was the head of the Tennessee Tribune newspaper.
Correct.
And she recently transitioned, so just acknowledging her, because she represents that same spirit that you've described in the family there in Nashville. You know, Stephen, you and I were on, we were on Stephen's podcast last week. Take a minute to tell people, Stephen, about Enliven Global Media. But one of the things I loved last week when I was your guest on your show was a 4 or 5 minute video that talked about wealth creation, the thing we're talking about now. And particularly, the message was a message about private banking and family banking. Here, share, Stephen, if you would, the synopsis of that video. And I'd love to have Jesse kind of respond, because you were touching that area about banking, Jesse, and that's something that it's happening in all of our families across the board, all of our communities. Stephen, go ahead.
Yes, first of all, thank you. I'll be sure to find that video real quick and post the link in the chat for everybody. The synopsis of it is basically that we need to, no one's going to come to save us. What we need to do is start utilizing our resources. I was sending a message to Ms. Sherry, Teresa, excuse me, about the fact that our communities need to start pulling our resources together, whether it be our churches, our community groups, or our families, or just a local group in the neighborhoods. Start pulling our monies together so then that way we can invest into the groups and communities, so then that way we control the narrative of what goes on in those communities. And now we can either add more property to the land, put people in those homes, and have it set to a way that it's now built generational wealth. We have to understand that it's not going to fit. Maybe, well, it will affect, but not so much immediate as it will do to long-term generations for further along. To use an example, we saw what happened with, let's say, the Jewish community, for example, in the early 1930s, 40s, what have you. They did everything where, you know, everybody worked in the family, everybody worked, invested into these different groups. Same thing with other communities, did the same thing as well. Everybody back then, everybody either became the teacher, the local meat person, whatever, or you went to the military, or you was, you know, something of that nature. Then you, after you worked 10 to 20 years, when you were 30, you put all that money back in the thing and you put the next person, the next family up. Now, who are all these people? They're the senators, they're the congressmen and things like that, starting in the 50s, 60s, 70s. We missed that playbook. We knew it, we didn't do it. We do the same thing. And now you do that, or also start investing back in yourselves and become your own bank. And now you can start lending that money out and perform the same practices that we did, that's everybody's done for themselves with fintech and banking. Once you do that, you control the narrative and you'll be able to have more control of your assets and your funding.
I like that whole concept.
And so part of this, yeah, go ahead, Jesse.
I'm sorry. I'm very in tune with that concept and how it worked for the Jewish community. One of the problems we've had because of public policy and the way things have materialized against us with all the new immigrants coming in and all the issues that are out there is that we have to do something that's radical on public policy side. At the same time, we have to tighten up our investments so that we can have the leverage. During the civil rights movement in Nashville, the sit-ins, they didn't change their heart. What they did is they lost in the pocketbook. And so when they were going bankrupt, they had a little change. If we look at Target Corporation in Minneapolis, you can make your own judgment. I like the scenario where you show the video and you let people make their own decision rather than try to influence them with what you see, because they see the same thing you see. I believe that on public policy, because we were enslaved over 400 years in this whole process from Africa to this part of the world, if you believe that story, that we shouldn't pay any income tax for at least 400 years. Why? Because if you look at a generation, we're only 167 or 69 years from the Civil War, and we're still being attacked in public policy areas that prohibit our future generations from really being a part of America that they talk about. I also believe that we should also never give up the right to public access and public opportunity. And in our communities, for those who want to live in those communities, they have the flexibility of knowing that the jobs will be reinvested with the tax dollars that are all around them. I look at Shakopee, I look at Chaska, I look at the federal dollars that have gone into those communities. So I've been here 50 years. It never reached where I grew up in other parts of the country. We paid federal tax, but we didn't get the benefit of it. So I think we have to really come down hard on that. And we cannot compromise any longer someone deliberately not allowing our children to have a decent education. There's some things that children should never have to experience. I know what they are. And if I asked everybody to just think about it for a moment, what hurdles should a child not have to go through? Well, we can talk about it at the micro or macro level, but in the end, there's just too much power. I mean, some kids are in, adolescents are in criminal preparations in juvenile when they're adolescents. So we could go off into all those and everybody could have their silo, but at the end of the day, enough is enough. And I think Target lost maybe 38% of its gross revenue. And they were, some of the management that was very straightforward. They didn't want black people coming to their stores. They said, go to Walmart. Okay. Well, guess what? They're firing people over there now, and they're trying to get reorganized over at Target. But around the country, Target is not a preferred corporate partner in the African-American community. But here again, there are other strategies that could be developed if we collectively put our minds together, how to use the economic leverage to at least put a fence and protection around our community so we can build it and not be moved every 10 years to another community because some other development's coming in and taking the land away from the people who live in. Last comment I'll make about that is, in Tennessee, the Confederates declared any place that they had during the Civil War where they lost blood as sacred land. But where we live, no, it's up for grabs. Push them out, bring in some new people. So,
Mr. Overton, if you don't let me, jump in here. You're great. Yeah. All of you are correct. The one thing I want to say that we have to do in intention, with intention beforehand, is understand the language and understand money, understand the business aspect. Here's what's happening. We're jumping in. You know, for example, a large amount of our communities use Cash App, let's just do, for example, or Venmo and PayPal, stuff like that. But they don't know that there's these investment buttons that less than 1% or 2%, something like that, is using these buttons that you can buy stocks and information. So many people don't even understand Robinhood or how money works, how investments work, how stock work, how the weather is affecting the market or the government. They don't understand. All they just see is the president did this, but it'd be bad. But don't understand the trickle-down effect up and down of it, these effects with in terms of money, how the language is being used. People don't, you know, when we talk about rural or urban does not mean black, but you have to be careful how that language is being used. So then that way they can get into the neighborhoods and buy up the land and outsource you. And then now you are being gentrified in your neighborhoods or in your communities and businesses. We have to understand how money works and language, to the point of we look at PBS, we talk about songs, letters, numbers, all our youth knows all the rap music or songs and anything else, but to the, even Bible verses, but to that same level, we understand these things. We need to understand how money and the language and all this works together. Then we have the tools and we can, so people are not talking over our heads or what they say is TMI is too much, all these different things, because we do not have the tools. Learn the tools, and then you'll be better prepared. Then we can go into those avenues that you talked about, sir.
I agree with you, but at the end, we can't wait for that to happen at every level. Numeracy is an issue, whether you're white or black in America. And we have enough intelligence within our own group to do things that don't require us to trust one another, but to make good financial decisions that have major impact. And so rather than going down one path, waiting for another one, another century to happen, we have to do something radical. I don't know the answer to it. I do know this. We need to collectively figure out what the next step's gonna be. Humanity, when I think about it, habitat is, house is a beginning, but you have to develop all of the habitat so that it's a wonderful place to live in. And the time is now. I mean, I'm not Democrat, Republican, Independent. I'm pro the development of my kids and the kids that they have to interface with. And so we've done the outreach. The only question now is how do we pick up and get everybody's sale to sale. If a family can have a home and a job close to where they are and provide for their own family, I want that to happen now, not tomorrow. And by the way, John Lewis, he spent a lot of time at my uncle's restaurant, and his frustration in the civil rights movement was it was going to be forever, and he wanted something to happen right now. We've been through this so many times. Do we need to repeat what we've done before, or do we need to build and go beyond?
Yeah.
I don't have an answer, but we will go beyond. A good example is I was visiting with a student, and he said, "Mr. Overton, I'm tired of people telling me I need to learn how to read and do math. I can do math better than my teacher with my cell phone. I can get any answer to any question you give me with Google." So we had a long, engaging conversation. I think I did get that student to think a little bit differently about what would happen if he didn't have it. But there is an adjustment going on with the youth that the adults are not in tune with. And it's not all necessarily negative. There's an adaptation going on. So it's just a wonderful opportunity for us to revisit this subject matter. And I can see where some of the people in my age group, in particular advocates around the cities here, are stuck in the mud on certain things, and other people that have difference of opinion with them are stuck. But the reality is, what is the outcome of where they stand financially? And your point's well taken. I mean, we have to understand the financial models, but we can also make them viable through the new technology. The data centers they're talking about building, it's going to be interesting to understand. I mean, that's a whole nother ballpark. $50 billion for a data center. I had a conversation with a guy at Marshall Bank in D.C. today, and he actually believes that there's going to be a huge bust of the data centers. People in the they're embracing AI. Well, there's some things that AI models work for and some that they don't. So I don't know that I need to know everything, but I can't disagree with you that we don't have the financial base collectively across all these groups. We have some institutional problems going on that people are participating in. The last thing I can share with you, I'm on the PBS board, Twin City Public Health Board, and they developed a program called Skillsville. The president decided to destroy that program and took $10 million of work away from TPT. Skillsville is teaching pre-K students what job opportunities and careers are out there. You know, when you grow up, you say, "I want to be a fireman, I want to be a policeman." For some reason, that was very, very threatening to the president of the United States. Teaching pre-kids, and by the way, in the Twin Cities, 62% of all the kids that watch PBS are African-American. So media has to be trusted, but we have to have public policy, and we have to be engaged so that we can get the best opportunities for our kids in developing in trauma situations to have it. On about 22% of African-Americans are below the poverty line in Minnesota, and we're bigger than the Somalian community in terms of raw numbers. We're about 264,000. And all we hear about is how bad the 22% is doing, but other people working 2 and 3 jobs. And we got to get the media held accountable as to what are you actually programming the other communities to think of those of us who are decent citizens, providing for our families.
Listen, we're seeing and Steve time. And thank you both so very much. Thank you to all of my guests today. What a wonderful program. Al McFarland, the conversation with Al McFarland. Go to Insight News and you'll see a story, the headline. I want you to check out, if you get a chance to, that building must begin before a child can spell college. It's a story about Sandra Samuels and her work at the Northside community. See you next time. Thank you so much for being here. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.